introducing today is somebody who I just had the great privilege of getting to get to know yesterday. For about an hour we spoke, and it was an amazing conversation, and it really meant a lot to me yesterday, and I hope that you guys are able to feel a little bit of that today. So I will read this from the Area 9 archives. This This tape is produced for the Mid-Southern California Area Archives, and as such will not be reproduced for other uses. This tape will remain in the custody of the Mid-Southern California Area Archives. In the interest of anonymity, we ask that no last names be stated. Now, do I have your permission to tape this interview, Judy?
Yes, you do.
Okay, great. So, okay, let's get to it then. Please state your first name and sobriety date.
My name is Judy, and my sobriety date is October 8th, 1977.
Thank you so much. And where did you get sober?
I got sober at TLC in Torrance, California.
Cool. Now, I know we talked a little bit about this yesterday because I also got sober at the TLC. But tell me a little bit about how you first came to AA, how you first heard about AA, and when eventually you started going to AA for your own recovery.
I first heard about Alcoholics Anonymous as a youngster. I had an uncle who was a wino, and he came to a family gathering with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and was telling the family that he's found a way to change his life. And his sisters talked him out of it right there at the family table and said, you don't need those people. They don't even know who you are, and we can help you. And unfortunately, my uncle lived a long time and died a horrible alcoholic death.
Sorry.
So that was my first time I ever heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous when I was a youngster. Fast forward, drugs, sex, rock and roll, alcohol, all of that good kind of stuff. Oh, first of all, before I get started, I want to thank Joan so much for sharing herself with us today. You gave me hope, and I really, really appreciate that. And isn't it wonderful how now you have a whole new life and a whole bunch of new people in your life, and yeehaw for that. Thanks for sharing it with us. So I had a lot of drinking to do. And I ended up, my last 5 years of drinking, I was living in South Dakota in this little town where there wasn't much else to do besides drink. And I figured my problems stemmed from the fact that I was living in South Dakota. If you lived in South Dakota, you would have to drink too, because I'm a California gal, and South Dakota is not California in any way, shape, or form. So anyway, I came back to California thinking that, and the first person I called was a using buddy from high school, and just kind of picked up right there. And she asked me if I would go with her to an AA meeting because she felt she had a problem. And I felt she had a problem too. And I said, sure, I'll be glad to. And so my problem wasn't with alcohol as far as my warped thinking was concerned. My problem was the fact that I lost the power of choice. Prior to crossing into alcoholism, we didn't have this term then back then, but I could be the designated driver. I could be the one who'd say, okay, I'm not going to drink tonight. You guys all get stoned. I'll make sure you get home safe. But once I crossed into alcoholism, around the age of 24-ish in there, I no longer had that choice. I would say, oh, sure, I'm not going to drink tonight. And then here I am, drunk and, you know, like it says in the big book, pounding on the bar. How did this happen? And I'd put in a lot of controls. You know, I'd ask my friends, you know, let me know when I've had 9 Blue Hawaiis. And when they would tell me, Judy, and then I'd, you know, go off on them. What the hell? You can't tell me how much. Anyway. So, So I came to AA to support my friend, not thinking that I had a problem, but I talked to people before and after, you know, and people in AA are so kind. They don't say, what do you want with us? They go, keep coming back, honey. Just keep coming back. We have a lot of open meetings. You don't have to identify as an alcoholic. You just keep coming back. And so I thought that I had learned enough and that I was safe. And I went to a Greek festival that Torrance has every year, and out there dancing, having a good time, and a bottle of ouzo came and I drank it. No thought, no, not one of those members of Alcoholics Anonymous came into my head, none of that. And the next day I came to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and raised my hand, and all those wonderful people I talked to, oh, yay, you know. We're so kind to those poor little newcomers that come in that don't know their ups from their downs. Yeah, so that's how I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, on accident, so to speak.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I know I told you this yesterday, but I relate to that also. I think I went to AA for months before I could identify as an alcoholic in meetings too. We had a conversation yesterday, and I really loved some of your stories about some of the 12-step work that you did in your early recovery. And I'm wondering if maybe you can talk a little bit about what 12-step work was like when you were getting sober and back then.
I'd love to. It was way different. I agree with Joan. There were no 800 numbers to call. There's no midnight advertisements on television. Do you have a drink? Are you drunk now? Call 1-8. You know, there was none of that. So occasionally I think there were public service announcements on television and advertisements in newspapers and that sort of thing. It's so different than it is now. Now there's a rehab on every corner, especially in Southern California. And you could be of service in a couple of different ways on 12-step calls. You could take the hotline, the AA hotline, and so that means that the switchboard operator would direct a call that came in to your phone, and you could take it and talk to them. Yeah. And that was sometimes very interesting and a lot of fun. And one of the things that any kind of 12-step call did for me is help me appreciate that I had found Alcoholics Anonymous, that I wasn't in the places, the precarious places that some of these folks are in. But one of my favorite 12-step stories, there were two went on a call, and usually it was two women or two men, but not always, because not all the time was that set of people available, you know. So anyway, on this one particular call, I went with Baseball Terry. And when I got sober, a lot of people had double names. And Harvard General Hospital over in Torrance, they were constantly changing their policy of whether we could drop off wet drunks or not. And at this time, they had said, no, don't bring us any wet drunks. Don't just drop them off. And so we went to this lady's house, and oh, she was so sick, so very, very sick. And we asked her, do you want to go to the hospital? Because you're really sick. And she said, yes. And so we loaded her into Terry's truck, and we went to Harbor General Hospital, and I jumped out and got a wheelchair. And then we got the dear lady in a wheelchair. And then I took a running, pushing that chair right as fast as I could. And when it got close to the door, I just let go and turned around. And Terry pulled up in his truck, and I jumped in, and we drove off, because otherwise they'd give her back to us. And that's my very favorite memory. I don't know what happened to that lady. She never showed up in a meeting that I was in. But Terry and I stayed sober another day, and we had a lot of good times talking about the trick we pulled on Harvard General Hospital.
I think that is so funny. You know, we often hear about people breaking out of hospitals, but it sounds like you were helping this person break into a hospital. That cracks me up.
Yeah, because you know, once somebody's in there, they have to deal with them. They can't push them back out.
Right. So you would hope so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that Marika had touched on this in the interview with Joan, and we had talked a little bit about this yesterday. With the way that, especially in Southern California and in Orange County and in the Long Beach area, with so many rehab centers on every block, and you go to Orange County, you see them everywhere in Orange County. Do you think that the classic 12-step call, 12-step work that you were doing in your early years in AA, do you think that's a dying thing?
Well, you know, we're required to change with the times. You know, but we don't know what the future might. We may go back to those kind of 12-step calls. You know, the popularity of rehabs may die out and we may have to go back to that. I certainly, but what the big thing is, there's lots of ways to make 12-step calls. If you have some meetings, one or two meetings that you show up to regularly, you're making a 12-step call on the rest of that group because you're there, you know, and people get comfortable with that sense of familiarity. They walk in, and oh, there's Judy. She's sitting over where she always sits. And oh, she moved today. She's sitting in a different place. Or there's Skip. Oh, my heavens. I haven't seen, you know, don't sit in that chair because that one belongs to Jerry, you know, or that kind of stuff. And that's, we get such a sense of belonging from that kind of camaraderie, you know, and people get the idea that if they don't show up, they're going to be missed too. You know, we give that's a 12-step call. As far as I'm concerned, you're carrying the message of recovery. I mean, Joan carried the message of recovery to everybody on this meeting today. You know, she says, "Stay, don't drink no matter what, and you'll be amazed where your life will go. Even when you get this old, it'll go someplace different." You know, isn't that, I think that's such a powerful 12-step call that she made on me today. So, I'm not into like bashing all the changes. Some of them I don't like. I'm not real fond of the chanting that we do in meetings sometimes, but I'm not one to like, I don't pine away for the old days. Because I think these young kids are bringing us some amazingly good stuff. And I want to be part of that.
Very cool. Thank you so much. I couldn't agree more there. Now, I want to go back to your early recovery. And could you tell me about when you first got a sponsor and what made you pick this woman as your sponsor?
Yeah, my first sponsor was an old hippie like me. She played a guitar, and I admired that. And, you know, they say, if you want what we have, you know, look around, pick somebody who has what you want. And her ability to play the guitar was an attraction. That's it. And she guided me through the steps. And I love to tell the story about, I don't know about anybody else, but I had an inflated sense of, I had no self-esteem, but an inflated sense of who I was and how important I was. That is so bizarre to me. But so when it came time for my fifth step, she had a camper. And so we met in the parking lot, far end of the parking lot at a grocery store in this camper, so nobody could hear my fifth step, like, ugh. And when it got to the sex part, I started stuttering, and I don't stutter. And she said, oh, you're having a little hard time there. And I said, yeah. And she says, well, let me tell you a little bit of my fifth step in the sex department. And so she told me some things, and I was like, oh, fuck, man, I can tell this lady anything. I can tell her absolutely anything. And it was such a, you know, yeah, it was a huge, an absolutely huge relief. And in those days, we burned inventory. I wish now that we didn't, because I would love to see what I wrote back then. But we had a little ceremony in her camper, and we, you know, caught her little gentle drapes over the sink and caught them on fire. It was all, you know, just wonderfully dramatic. And but it would be nice to know what I had written, because my memory doesn't, it knows the big chunks, but some of the little details are gone. So that was my first sponsor.
Oh, I love hearing your experience with your first fifth step with your sponsor. And I'm curious, is there anything else that maybe you can tell us today about the first time you took the 12 steps and any other transformative experiences you might have had?
Well, first of all, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous as an atheist. I used to get stoned and argue against the existence of God. And that's the best way to do that kind of argument, is because your mind is so, you know, whatever. Anyway, so the meeting hall where I went, they had up on the wall the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I was sitting in a meeting, and, you know, I'd been going to meetings for a little while, but I never saw those things before. Isn't that weird? It's so strange to me. But so I said, I saw God. But excuse my language, but this is what I said to myself: girl, you are fucked. This is the only hope for alcoholism, is Alcoholics Anonymous. And they have God. So I said to the woman sitting next to me, I said, I can't stay, I have to go. And she said, how come? And I said, because you have God. And I don't believe there is such a thing. And she said, well, honey, let me ask you this. You know how old ladies always call kids honey? It's just an amazing thing. Anyway, she said, is there a power greater than yourself in this universe? And I'd been a body surfer here in California and in Hawaii. And I said, yeah, the Pacific Ocean. You step into the Pacific Ocean and the ocean owns you. And she said, well, that's all you need, honey. That's all you need. All you need to start in Alcoholics Anonymous is to believe that there's a power greater than yourself. So that made it possible for me to work the steps, because I didn't, I got the concept of God as I understand God, that God is just a term, makes the conversation a little easier if you use the word God than if you have all these different names. Anyway, so that's what got me started, is like I turned my will and my life over to the care of the Pacific Ocean. And I'm, you know, Bill Wilson had a hot flash, he had a spiritual experience, and he called it his hot flash. I didn't have a hot flash. I wouldn't have trusted a hot flash, because I would have figured I made it up in my head. But I had the educational variety. I had little coincidences along the line. It's like, man, that worked out. Well, look at that. That worked out. You know, the people showing up in my life at just the right moment, or me showing up in somebody else's life at just the right moment. Coincidences, God shots, whatever you want to call them. I had so many of them in my first years of sobriety that I got, that I have a higher power that adores me and takes really good care of me. And because of that, process, it didn't happen overnight, but it was a process for me. It made working the steps worthwhile. You know, I'm like most people, I want a benefit, I want a payoff. And, you know, the promises come in the middle of the ninth step. Well, I started having those things happen before I got to the ninth step. Those little coincidences, little God shots, little things that I learned to call miracles. And that kept me going. Kept me going. I mean, it's worth doing if you're getting, if you're, you know, I felt better. I started to treat people differently. I used to be such a sarcastic person. It was, I took great pleasure. I was mean. I took great, great pleasure in attacking people verbally and physically once in a while, but mostly verbally, just out of meanness, just because I could. And I started noticing I'm not as mean as I used to be. How did that happen? I didn't ask to not be mean. I thought it was a character asset. And yeah, so I got changed as a result of working the steps. The result, you know, that they ask us to reflect on our part. What's my part in it? And how can I do it differently in the future? And I slowly started to change. And as I slowly started to change, my life got better and I started enjoying it more. You know, I was prone to miss, you know, the bedevilments on page, I'm a big book thumper, by the way. On page 52, it talks about the bedevilments that we have. It describes the poor suffering alcoholic. That's me. They wrote about me. They wrote about me there. They wrote about me and more about alcoholism. Because I switched from this to that, I counted, So that's been part of my journey too, is discovering more about myself and my alcoholism as time has gone on.
Thank you so much. We talked a little bit about this yesterday, and you've been sober 42 years, correct?
Correct.
Now, I've only been alive for 23 years.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
42 years just sounds to me unfathomable, you know. I shared with you yesterday that I go through long periods of complacency in my sobriety, resting on my laurels. How do you keep things fresh after 42 years of sobriety? How do you prevent yourself from resting on your laurels?
Well, do you know what laurels are? I don't mean to put you on the spot. Okay, so the Greeks used to make these laurel wreaths for their head, right?
Okay.
Well, so if you think about those, they're kind of like, we have hedges here in California that have little red berries on them and the leaves have real pointy spikes on them. And laurel leaves are like that too. So if you rest on your royal butt on the laurel leaves, they're going to poke you. They're going to poke you. And that, so my experience is that when I have leaned toward resting on my laurels, like I've done enough service work. I mean, my God, I've been on this and this and this. I've done, let everybody else take care of that. You know, I have set up chairs for 100 years. I am so freaking tired of setting up chairs. Let somebody else do it. When I have started leaning in that direction, I've been very fortunate and I get poked real easy. I must be tender because I get really poked real easy. And it's like a bitterness starts happening inside of me. And I don't want to be a bitter person. I can't see, when I see bitter people, it's like, ooh, I don't want what you got. So probably the most important thing I've done is to do my best to stay in the middle. You know, so I'm connected to people ahead of me, I'm connected to people behind me, and I'm connected to the people beside me. And to be in the middle, you're not so likely to get picked off by the tigers and lions and things that pick alcoholics off. And sponsorship, oh my God, I think everybody should sponsor, because every time I get a new sponsee, I meet another part of myself, which is part of the fun of being sober for a long time. You know, they may have an interest that I never heard of, and then I want to know more, and that gets, I have a curious mind, and that takes me off in this direction or that direction, or you know, more is revealed as we go along. We do our best to be honest and thorough in our inventory, and we do a 10th step every day to keep us there. But I've had the experience of somebody I sponsor telling me a little something about their life, and it's like, bingo, completely forgot about that. Okay, time to get to work on this. Completely out of my head, you know. And I'm a reader, and I've had new people tell me about authors that I had never heard of, and I've found some interesting books to read as a result of that. I mean, and when we had in-face meetings, you know, there were certain meetings I had, that's where I usually sat in a certain section. I'm a human animal, you know, we like to be in the same spot. And I want to be where I can make a note of any newcomers or people I've never seen at that meeting before. And I call, sometimes I kiddingly call myself the social director of whatever meeting, but it's my job. And I sincerely feel it's my job to go and introduce myself to those new people or those new faces and welcome them. And if somebody comes in and they're looking for a place to sit, if there's a chair near me, I tap the chair and say, honey, you just come over here and sit down next to me. And yeah, that keeps me in the middle. It keeps it fun. It keeps it interesting. Sometimes we go on adventures and a couple people I sponsor and I will make a road trip to a meeting we've never been before and check it out. And I love the camaraderie. I love the fellowship. That's probably the thing that's been hardest for me in this lockdown situation is I miss that energy exchange that we have when we're in person, because it's stronger and I like stronger, always have.
Now we have about 15 minutes left, and I want to get into the meat and potatoes, so to say, what I was most fascinated with regarding your story. I understand that you've done a lot of service work with the LGBT community and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to talk to us, for the viewers and listeners here, a little bit about that and a little bit about KISSAR and what that is and how that came.
Well, I'm glad to. So I'm what is that word? Serial monogamist. I got married young, got divorced, got sober. Got married, got divorced, got married. And you know, you hear the most amazing things at meetings that will sometimes stay in your brain. And somebody said at one point in my early years of sobriety, they said, if you want to know why you're doing something, stop doing it. And after that last divorce, I never got married thinking, oh, I'm going to divorce this sucker in 2 years, 5 years, whatever. But I always got married thinking this is going to be forever. And so after the last divorce, my prayer every day was, God, please don't let me do that to myself or another human being again. And that prayer got me on a journey of self-discovery. And the reason I kept getting married is I didn't want me or anybody else to know that who I really wanted to be married to was a woman. And that was an extremely painful revelation for me. I got flashbacks from my childhood, and I won't go into that ugly story, but it was ugly. And so for the rest of my life, from 11 years old on, I was trying to prove to my father that I wasn't what he said I was. And so in order to deal with this, I went into therapy. And I had been going to women's events for years with my friends, my lesbian friends. I had a lot of lesbian friends, never thinking that maybe I was too. And yes, I went into therapy and was able to go through all of that ugly, ugly stuff and come to terms with, this is who I am. This isn't a lifestyle choice. No, this is actually who I was born to be. And I was living in Orange County at the time. And I was a general service rep for a Tuesday night meeting. And I was at a GSR meeting, and this big old tall guy named Jim H. came and sat down next to me, and we started bragging about our meetings. And he said, yeah, I represent the best gay meeting in Orange County. And I said, there's gay meetings in Orange County? And he said, yeah, we have a few. We even have a gay roundup called Miracles Happens. And so I started going to the best gay A meeting in Orange County. I don't even know if it's in existence or not, but and from that I got involved in Miracles Happens, which is a gay and lesbian roundup in Orange County. And so after a couple of years, I moved to Long Beach. My employment changed and I moved to Long Beach. And, you know, Long Beach is a very diverse community and has a big and lively and active gay recovery community in all of the 12-step programs. When I moved to Long Beach, there was a roundup here called ODAT, One Day at a Time. And it was lovely. It was absolutely lovely. So I got on that committee and I did my 5 years of rotation through that committee. And then it moved on. Other people were the committee. And the people who ended up as the committee operating it were people who didn't go to gay meetings. They went to straight meetings. And they made the conclusion that queers were so well integrated into straight AA in Long Beach that we no longer needed a gay roundup. And I didn't agree with that. And one of the people who served on the committee with me in Miracles Happens, Dan S., he didn't agree with it either. And so we got together, we had some coffee and a bitch session, and how could they do this? And, you know, if you're not in gay meetings, you don't see the children coming in whose parents have thrown them away. They don't show up at straight meetings. They show up at gay meetings, and they're in so much pain, and they don't believe that because they're queer, that a higher power could love them and want them sober, because that's what they've been told all their lives. So because Dan and I are in gay meetings all the time, we see that. And we really felt strongly that there should be a roundup, small, intimate, and safe. So our feelings were so strong that we said, well, we're going to put our money where our mouth is. And one of us is going to pay for this, and one of us is going to pay for that. And then we would invite other members of our community and see what happened. If it's meant to go, it's going to go. If it's not, oh, we'll just out some dollars, you know. And so we put the word out, and we started having committee meetings. Jerry B., an icon in our community, he named it KISSAR, Keep It Simple, Simply a Roundup. And so we had our first committee meeting and we got it going. That was in the late summer of 2005. We had our fund, well, ODAT had a lot of money when they disbanded. And so I called the treasurer and said, have you guys done anything with your money? And she said, no, we haven't. And I said, on the behalf of Dan S. and I, I'd like to ask for it because we want to start a roundup. And that committee voted to give us the money. So we never really had to have a fundraiser. So we had we wanted a fundraiser to get the word out that this is something that's going to happen. And so we had a spaghetti dinner in January, a spaghetti dinner and dessert auction. And if you need to raise some money for an event, have a dessert auction, especially amongst alcoholics, because the tables would get in these competitive biddings. And some of our desserts are sold for $400. And that's just money to go in making the events bigger and better and funner. I said bigger. No, we don't want KISSAR to get bigger because we want to keep it safe and small and intimate. So I called somebody who's currently on the committee, and in 2018, the attendance at the spaghetti dinner was 150 people. And the KISSAR event actually that happened that year was, there was 125 people in attendance. Last year, the spaghetti dinner was 175 people. And at the event itself, there was 150 people showed up. So it's something that is hugely supported by the community. We have such a good time. We have workshops all day Saturday. It's Friday night. The event is Friday night and Saturday, and a speaker and birthday celebration Saturday night. So it's, people can come from out of town just for the day. And last year, last March, Dan and I were just bawling because we had this dream. We had this dream about making a safe place for queers to come and have fun and enjoy. And you know, it's not just queers. We have a lot of straight people who like to spend time in our community because it's so loving and supportive. A lot of straight people come to gay meetings. So if you want to come, you're more than welcome. We don't kick anybody out. Well, if you're a troublemaker, yeah, we would. But I guess part of my message about that is, if you're a member of a straight recovery community and you have that oddball kid come in, please don't kick him out. But you might suggest to them that if you might feel more comfortable at these meetings over here. They're dying out there. And a lot of them are dual addicted. A lot of them have mental and emotional problems. But there's a home for them in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you as a member of whatever community that you're a member of can help by making them feel welcome. I sponsor a young woman who, when she finally got the nerve to come out to her sponsor said, I can't relate to that. You have to go find somebody else. And that breaks my heart. That breaks my heart. Whew. I get hot about stuff.
Judy, thank you so much. We have about 3 minutes left, a loose 3 minutes, and I get chills hearing you talk about this. Now, I belong to a group that has, some would say, has a history of not being particularly friendly to members of the LGBT community. And you speak very passionately about this topic. What would you say to not a newcomer, but anyone in AA, no matter how much time they have, an LGBT member of AA that walks into a meeting, it doesn't feel safe, you know, and that might begin to question whether or not they belong here? What sort of things would you say to that person?
To the one who doesn't think they belong?
Someone that, an LGBT member of AA that doesn't feel welcome or safe.
Well, I would definitely invite that person to come to gay meetings. You know, I am positive that you all, that every straight meeting has at least one queer in it who's hiding, who's afraid to come out, afraid for you to know who they really are, because you'd probably throw them away if you knew who they really were. You know, that's an issue. You know, the two people who are speaking after the break, the two Jerrys, they're going to talk about why gay meetings were started. You know, it's like a friend of mine says, this is, he said, how I make love to my sweetheart in a straight meeting, I will hear a man say, the worst thing I ever did, drunk, was. And it's not that we don't want you to tell the truth. It's that we want you to be aware that what you're saying has an impact on other people in the room. They're not going to hear that at a queer meeting. You know, what they're going to hear at the queer meeting really is basically what you hear at straight meetings. I got sober in straight meetings. It's pretty much the same message. But what we're going to tell you is, we're going to walk with you. You're going to be a member of our herd, and we're going to protect you, and we're going to keep you safe. And if you haven't come out any place in the world, that's okay. We're not going to tell anybody you're queer. Some people might suspect it if you're hanging out with Judy B, because she's queer, but not all my friends are queer. Not all my friends in recovery are queer. You know? So what can we do to make it safe for the newcomer? Not just the queer newcomer, or maybe the odd one, you know? Somebody maybe not be queer, but they come in and they're covered from tattoos from here to there, you know, or they have a bone through their nose or whatever. Do we go up and welcome them? Do we say, you have a home here? Even though you don't look like me, I'm going to make sure you have a home right here next to me. Do we do that as old timers? As old timers, do we walk up to the newcomers and say, hey, glad you're here? My favorite thing to say to a newcomer is, so did alcohol kick your ass? And that usually starts the conversation, because most people who come in, yeah, they've been whooped. So we have a responsibility statement, and I'd like to add to it. The responsibility statement says, anytime, anywhere, the hand of hand reaches out for AA, I want the hand of AA to be there. And I want to say, without prejudice, can we have the hand of AA be there? Well, you got me on my high horse here.
No, that is so powerful. I can't tell you how much it means to hear somebody say that. I've really enjoyed talking with you the last 2 days, and I so look forward to the day that we can meet in person. We are pretty much like 2 minutes over time, but I do still want to give you one last opportunity. Is there any lasting words that you would like to leave us with today? Anything else you'd like to share?
Probably the best piece of knowledge that I've received that's not in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is to stand guard at the portal of your mind. Your mind is precious. What kind of thoughts do you want it playing with? You know, I have a negative thinker. It creates these tragic gloom and doom stories. I also have a list of things that make my heart smile. So when I get caught up in the gloom and the doom stories, I get my list out and I think about what's on the list so that my heart can smile. If my heart is smiling, I'm not up here making gloom and doom stories. So please stand guard at the portal of your mind. It's precious. It's a precious place.
Okay. Thank you so much, Judy.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And I guess I'll turn it back over to Jerry now.